most ready for the task at hand. Think of it as selective editing, not to deceive others, but to properly orient ourselves. And it works. Small tweaks can change what once felt like impossible tasks. Suddenly, where we felt weak, we realize we are strong. With perspective, we can discover leverage we didn't know we had. Perspective has two definitions. One, context. A sense of the larger picture of the world, not just what is immediately in front of us. Two, framing. An individual's unique way of looking at the world. A way that interprets its events. Both matter. Both can be effectively injected to change a situation that previously seemed intimidating or impossible. George Clooney spent his first years in Hollywood getting rejected at auditions. He wanted the producers and the directors to like him, but they didn't and it hurt, and he blamed the system for not seeing how good he was. This perspective should sound familiar. It's the dominant viewpoint for the rest of us on job interviews, when we pitch clients or try to connect with an attractive stranger in a coffee shop. We subconsciously submit to what Seth Godin, author and entrepreneur, refers to as the tyranny of being picked. Everything changed for Clooney when he tried a new perspective. He realized that casting is an obstacle for producers too. They need to find someone. They're all hoping that the next person to walk into the room is the right somebody. Auditions were a chance to solve their problem, not his. From Clooney's new perspective, he was that solution. He wasn't going to be someone groveling for a shot. He was someone with something special to offer. He was the answer to their prayers, not the other way around. That was what he began projecting in his auditions, not exclusively his acting skills, but that he was the man for the job, that he understood what the casting director and producers were looking for in a specific role, and that he would deliver it in each and every situation, in pre-production, on camera, and during promotion. The difference between the right and the wrong perspective is everything. How we interpret the events in our lives, our perspective, is the framework for our forthcoming response, whether there will even be one, or whether we'll just lay there and take it. Where the head goes, the body follows. Perception precedes action. Right action follows the right perspective. Is it up to you? In life, our first job is this, to divide and distinguish things into two categories. Externals I cannot control, but the choices I make with regard to them I do control. Where will I find good and bad? In me, in my choices. Don't ever speak of good or bad or advantage or harm and so on of anything that is not your responsibility. Epictetus. Tommy John, one of baseball's most savvy and durable pitchers, played 26 seasons in the majors. 26 seasons! His rookie year, Kennedy was president. His final year, it was George H.W. Bush. He pitched to Mickey Mantle and Mark McGwire. It's an almost superhuman accomplishment. But he was able to do it because he got really good at asking himself and others, in various forms, one question over and over again. Is there a chance? Do I have a shot? Is there something I can do? All he ever looked for was a yes, no matter how slight or tentative or provisional the chance. If there was a chance, he was ready to take it and make good use of it, ready to give every ounce of effort and energy that he had to make it happen. If effort would affect the outcome, he would die on the field before he let that chance slip through his fingers. The first time came during the middle of the 1974 season, when Tommy John blew out his arm, permanently damaging the ulnar collateral ligament in his pitching elbow. Up until this point in baseball and sports medicine, when a pitcher blew out his arm, that was it. They called it a dead arm injury. Game over. John wouldn't accept that. Was there anything that could give him a shot to get back on the mound? It turns out there was. The doctors suggested an experimental surgery in which they would try to replace the ligament in his pitching arm with a tendon from his other arm. What are the chances of me coming back after this surgery? 1 in 100. And without it? No chance, they said. He could have retired, but there was a 1 in 100 chance. With rehab and training, the opportunity was partially in his control. He took it and won 164 more games over the next 13 seasons. That procedure is now famously known as Tommy John surgery. Less than 10 years later, John mustered the same spirit and effort he marshaled for his elbow surgery when his young son fell horrifyingly from a third-story window, swallowed his tongue, and nearly died. Even in the chaos of the emergency room, with the doctors convinced that the boy probably wouldn't survive, John reminded his family that whether it takes 1 or 10 years, they wouldn't give up until there was absolutely nothing left that they could do. His son made a full recovery. With John, his baseball career seemed to finally come to an end in 1988, when at the age of 45, he was cut by the Yankees at the end of the season. Still, he would not accept it. He called the coach and demanded, if he showed up to spring training as a walk-on the next spring, would he get a fair look? They replied that he shouldn't be playing baseball at his age. He repeated the question, be straight with me. If I come down there, would I have a chance? The baseball officials answered, fine, yes, you'll get one look. So Tommy John was the first to report to camp. He'd trained many hours a day, brought every lesson he'd learned playing the sport for a quarter century, and made the team as the oldest player in the game. He started the season opener and won, giving up a scant 2 runs over 7 innings on the road at Minnesota. The things that Tommy John could change, when he had a chance, got a full 100% of the effort he could muster. He used to tell coaches that he would die on the field before he quit. He understood that as a professional athlete, his job was to parse the difference between the unlikely and the impossible. Seeing that minuscule distinction was what made him who he was. To harness the same power, recovering addicts learn the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. This is how they focus their efforts. It's a lot easier to fight addiction when you aren't also fighting the fact that you were born, that your parents were monsters, or that you lost everything. That stuff is done, delivered, 0 in 100 chances that you can change it. So what if you focused on what you can change? That's where you can make a difference. Behind the serenity prayer is a 2,000-year-old Stoic phrase. Ta f emin, ta uk f emin. Or, what is up to us, what is not up to us. So, what is up to us? Our emotions, our judgments, our creativity, our attitude, our perspective, our desires, our decisions, our determination. This is our playing field, so to speak. Everything there is fair game. What is not up to us? Well, you know, everything else. The weather, the economy, circumstances, other people's emotions or judgments, trends, disasters, etc. If what's up to us is the playing field, then what's not up to us are the rules and the conditions of the game. Factors that winning athletes make the best of and don't spend time arguing against, because there is no point. To argue, to complain, or worse, to just give up, these are choices. Choices that more often than not do nothing to get us across the finish line. When it comes to perception, this is the crucial distinction to make. The difference between the things that are in our power and the things that aren't. That's the difference between the people who can accomplish great things and the people who find it impossible to stay sober, to avoid not just drugs or alcohol, but all addictions. In its own way, the most harmful dragon we chase is the one that makes us think we can change things that are simply not ours to change. That someone decided not to fund your company, this isn't up to you. But the decision to refine and improve your pitch, that is. That someone stole your idea and got to it first? No. To pivot, improve it, or fight for what's yours? Yes. Focusing exclusively on what is in our power magnifies and enhances our power. But every ounce of energy directed at the things we cannot actually influence is wasted, self-indulgent, and self-destructive. So much power, ours and other people's, is frittered away in this manner. To see an obstacle as a challenge, to make the best of it anyway, that is also a choice that is up to us. Will I have a chance, coach? Ta af emin. Is this up to me? Live in the present moment. The trick to forgetting the big picture is to look at everything up close. Chuck Palahniuk. Do yourself a favor and run down the list of businesses started during depressions or economic crises. Fortune magazine, 90 days after the market crash of 1929, FedEx, the oil crisis of 1973, UPS, the panic of 1907, the Walt Disney Company, after 11 months of smooth operation, the 12th was the market crash of 1929, Hewlett-Packard, Great Depression, 1935, Charles Schwab, market crash of 1974-75, Standard Oil. Rockefeller bought out his partners in what became Standard Oil and took over in February 1865, the final year of the Civil War. Coors, the Depression of 1873. Costco, recession in the late 70s. Revlon, Great Depression 1932. General Motors, panic of 1907. Procter & Gamble, panic of 1837. United Airlines, 1929. Microsoft, recession in 1973 to 1975. LinkedIn, 2002 post.com bubble. For the most part, these businesses had no idea they were in some historically significant depression. Why? Because the founders were too busy existing in the present, actually dealing with the situation at hand. They didn't know whether it would get better or worse. They just knew what it was. They had a job they wanted to do, a great idea they believed in, or a product they thought they could sell. They knew they had payroll to meet. Yet in our own lives, we aren't content to deal with things as they happen. We have to dive endlessly into what everything means, whether something is fair or not, what's behind this or that, and what everyone else is doing. Then we wonder why we don't have the energy to actually deal with our problems. Or we get ourselves so worked up and intimidated because of overthinking that if we just got into work, we'd probably be done already. Our understanding of the world of business is all mixed up with storytelling and mythology. Which is funny because we're missing the real story by focusing on individuals. In fact, half the companies in the Fortune 500 were started during a bear market or recession. Half. The point is, most people start from disadvantage, often with no idea they are doing so, and do just fine. It's not unfair. It's universal. Those who survive it because they took things day by day. That's the real secret. Focus on the moment, not the monsters that may or may not be ahead. A business must take the operating constraints of the world around it as a given and work for whatever gains are possible. Those people with an entrepreneurial spirit are like animals, blessed to have no time and no ability to think about the way things should be or how they'd prefer them to be. For all species other than us humans, things are just what they are. Our problem is that we're always trying to figure out what things mean, why things are the way they are, as though the why matters. Emerson put it best, we cannot spend the day in explanation, so don't waste time on false constructs. It doesn't matter whether this is the worst time to be alive or the best, whether you're in a good job market or a bad one, or that the obstacle you face is intimidating or burdensome. What matters is that right now is right now. The implications of our obstacle are theoretical. They exist in the past and in the future. We live in the moment. The more we embrace that, the easier the obstacle will be to face and move. You can take the trouble you're dealing with and use it as an opportunity to focus on the present moment, to ignore the totality of your situation and learn to be content with what happens as it happens, to have no way that the future needs to be to confirm your predictions because you didn't make any. To let each new moment be a refresh, wiping clear what came before it and what others were hoping would come next. You'll find the method that works best for you. But there are so many different things that can pull you into the present moment. Strenuous exercise, unplugging, a walk in the park, meditation, getting a dog. They're a constant reminder of how pleasant the present is. One thing is certain. It's not simply a matter of saying, oh, I'll live in the present. You have to work at it. Catch your mind when it wanders, discard distracting thoughts, leave things well enough alone, no matter how much you feel like doing otherwise. But it's easier when the choice to limit your scope feels like editing rather than acting. Remember that this moment is not your life. It is just a moment in your life. Focus on what is in front of you right now. Ignore what it represents or what it means or why it happened to you. There's plenty else going on right now to care about any of that. think differently. Genius is the ability to put into effect what is in your mind. There is no other definition of it. F. Scott Fitzgerald. Steve Jobs was famous for what observers called his reality distortion field. Part motivational tactic, part sheer drive and ambition. This field made him notoriously dismissive of phrases such as, it can't be done, or we need more time. Having learned early in life that reality was falsely hemmed in by rules and compromises that people had been taught as children, Jobs had a much more aggressive idea of what was or wasn't possible. To him, when you factored in vision and work ethic, much of life was malleable. For instance, in the design stages for a new mouse for an early Apple product, Jobs had high expectations. He wanted it to move fluidly in any direction, a new development for any mouse at that time. But a lead engineer was told by one of his designers that this would be commercially impossible. What Jobs wanted wasn't realistic and wouldn't work. The next day, the lead engineer arrived at work to find that Steve Jobs had fired the employee who said that. When the replacement came in, his first words were, "I can build the mouse." This was Jobs' view of reality at work, malleable, adamant, and self-confident. Not in the delusional sense, but for the purposes of accomplishing something. He knew that to aim low meant to accept mediocre accomplishment, but a high aim, if things went right, creates something extraordinary. He was Napoleon shouting to his soldiers, "There shall be no Alps." For most of us, such confidence does not come easy. It's understandable. So many people in our lives have preached the need to be realistic or conservative or worse, to not rock the boat. This is an enormous disadvantage when it comes to trying big things. Because though our doubts and self-doubts feel real, they have very little bearing over what is and isn't possible. Our perceptions determine, to an incredibly large degree, what we are and are not capable of. In many ways, they determine reality itself. When we believe in the obstacle more than in the goal, which will inevitably triumph? For instance, think of an artist. It is their unique vision and voice that pushes the definition of art forward. What was possible for an artist before Caravaggio, and then after Caravaggio stunned us with his dark masterpieces, were two very different things. Plug in any other thinker or writer or painter in their own time, and the same applies. This is why we shouldn't listen too closely to what other people say, or what the voice in our head says either. We'll find ourselves erring on the side of accomplishing nothing. Be open. Question. Though of course we don't control reality, our perceptions do influence it. 1 week before the first Macintosh computer was supposed to ship, the engineers told Jobs they couldn't make the deadline. On a hastily assembled conference call, the engineers explained that they needed just 2 additional weeks' work before it was ready. Jobs responded calmly, explaining to the engineer that if they could make it in 2 weeks, they could surely make it in 1. There was no real difference in such a short period of time. And more important, since they'd come this far and done such good work, there was no way they could not ship on January 16th, the original ship date. The engineers rallied and made their deadline. His insistence pushed them, once again, past what they ever thought possible. Now how do you and I usually deal with an impossible deadline handed down from someone above us? We complain. We get angry. We question. How could they? What's the point? Who do they think I am? We look for a way out and feel sorry for ourselves. Of course, none of these things affect the objective reality of that deadline, not in the way that pushing forward can. Jobs refused to tolerate people who didn't believe in their own abilities to succeed, even if his demands were unfair, uncomfortable, or ambitious. The genius and wonder of his products, which often felt impossibly intuitive and futuristic, embody that trait. He had pushed through what others thought were hard limitations, and as a result, he created something totally new. No one believed Apple could make the products it made. In fact, Jobs was pushed out in 1985 because the board members at the time felt that Apple's foray into consumer products was a lunatic plan. Of course, they were wrong. Jobs learned to reject the first judgments and the objections that spring out of them because those objections are almost always rooted in fear. When he ordered a special kind of glass for the first iPhone, the manufacturer was aghast at the aggressive deadline. "We don't have the capacity," they said. "Don't be afraid," Jobs replied. "You can do it. Get your mind around it. You can do it." Nearly overnight, manufacturers transformed their facilities into glass-making behemoths, and within 6 months, they'd made enough for the whole first run of the iPhone. This is radically different from how we've been taught to be. Be realistic, we're told. Listen to feedback. Play well with others. Compromise. Well, what if the other party is wrong? What if conventional wisdom is too conservative? It's this all-too-common impulse to complain, defer, and then give up that holds us back. An entrepreneur is someone with faith in their ability to make something where there was nothing before. To them, the idea that no one has ever done this or that is a good thing. When given an unfair task, some rightly see it as a chance to test what they're made of, to give it all they've got, knowing full well how difficult it will be to win. They see it as an opportunity because it is often in that desperate nothing-to-lose state that we are our most creative. Our best ideas come from there, where obstacles illuminate new options. Finding the opportunity. A good person dyes events with his own color and turns whatever happens to his benefit. Seneca. One of the most intimidating and shocking developments in modern warfare was the German Blitzkrieg, or Lightning War. In World War II, the Germans wanted to avoid the drawn-out trench fighting of previous wars, so they concentrated mobile divisions into rapid, narrow offensive forces that caught their enemies completely unprepared. Like the tip of a spear, columns of panzer tanks rushed into Poland, the Netherlands, Belgium, and France with devastating results and little opposition. In most cases, the opposing commanders simply surrendered rather than face what felt like an invincible, indefatigable monster bearing down on them. The Blitzkrieg strategy was designed to exploit the flinch of the enemy. He must collapse at the sight of what appears to be overwhelming force. Its success depends completely on this response. This military strategy works because the set-upon troops see the offensive force as an enormous obstacle bearing down on them. This is how the Allied opposition viewed the Blitzkrieg for most of the war. They could see only its power and their own vulnerability to it. In the weeks and months after the successful invasion of Normandy by Allied forces, they faced it again, a set of massive German counteroffensives. How could they stop it? Would it throw them back into the very beaches they'd just purchased at so high a cost? A great leader answered that question. Striding into a conference room at the headquarters in Malta, General Dwight D. Eisenhower made an announcement. He'd have no more of this quivering timidity from his deflated generals. The present situation is to be regarded as an opportunity for us, and not disaster, he commanded. There will only be cheerful faces at this conference table. In that surging counteroffensive, Eisenhower was able to see the tactical solution that had been in front of them the entire time, that the Nazi strategy carried its own destruction within itself. Only then were the Allies able to see the opportunity inside the obstacle, rather than simply the obstacle that threatened them. Properly seen, as long as the Allies could bend and not break, this attack sent more than 50,000 Germans rushing headfirst into a net, or a meat grinder, as Patton eloquently put it. The Battle of the Bulge, and before that, the Battle of the Falaise Pocket, which both were feared to be major reversals in the end of the Allies' momentum, in fact were their greatest triumphs. By allowing a forward wedge of the German army through and then attacking from the sides, the Allies encircled the enemy completely from the rear. The invincible penetrating thrust of the German panzers wasn't just impotent but suicidal, a textbook example of why you never leave your flanks exposed. More important, it's a textbook example of the role our own perceptions play in the success or failures of those who oppose us. It's one thing to not be overwhelmed by obstacles, or discouraged or upset by them. This is something that few are able to do. But after you have controlled your emotions, and you can see objectively and stand steadily, the next step becomes possible. A mental flip, so you're looking not at the obstacle but at the opportunity within it. As Laura Ingalls Wilder put it, there is good in everything, if only we look for it. Yet we are so bad at looking. We close our eyes to the gift. Imagine if you'd been in Eisenhower's shoes, with an army racing towards you, and you'd seen only impending defeat. How much longer would the war have gone on? How many more lives lost? It's our preconceptions that are the problem. They tell us that things should or need to be a certain way, So when they're not, we naturally assume we are at a disadvantage, or that we'd be wasting our time to pursue an alternate course, when really it's all fair game and every situation is an opportunity for us to act. Let's take a circumstance we've all been in, having a bad boss. All we see is the hell. All we see is the thing bearing down on us. We flinch. But what if you regarded it as an opportunity instead of a disaster? If you mean it when you say you're at the end of your rope and you would rather quit, you actually have an opportunity to change and grow and improve yourself. A unique opportunity to experiment with different solutions, to try different tactics, or to take on new projects to add to your skill set. You could study this bad boss and learn from him, while you fill out your resumes and hit up contacts for a better job elsewhere. You could prepare yourself for that job by trying new styles of communication or standing up for yourself, all with a perfect safety net for yourself, quitting and getting out of there. With this new attitude and fearlessness, who knows, you might be able to exact concessions and find that you like the job again. One day the boss will make a mistake, and then you'll make your move and outmaneuver him. It will feel so much better than the alternative, whining, bad-mouthing, duplicity, spinelessness. Or take that long-time rival at work, or that rival company, the one who causes endless headaches. Note the fact that they keep you alert, raise the stakes, motivate you to prove them wrong, harden you, help you appreciate your friends, provide an instructive antelogue, an example of who you don't want to become. Or that computer glitch that erased all your work. You will now be twice as good at it since you will do it again. How about that business decision that turned out to be a mistake? Well, you had a hypothesis and it turned out to be wrong. Why should that upset you? It wouldn't piss off a scientist. It would help him. Maybe don't bet so much on it next time. And now you've learned two things, that your instinct was wrong and the kind of appetite for risk you really have. Blessings and burdens are not mutually exclusive. It's a lot more complicated. Socrates had a mean, nagging wife. He always said that being married to her was good practice for philosophy. Of course you'd want to avoid something negative if you could, but what if you were able to remember, in the moment, the second act that seems to come with the unfortunate situations we try so hard to avoid? Sports psychologists recently did a study of elite athletes who were struck with some adversity or serious injury. Initially, each reported feeling isolation, emotional disruption, and doubts about their athletic ability. Yet afterwards, each reported gaining a desire to help others, additional perspective, and a realization of their own strength. In other words, every fear and doubt they felt during the injury turned into greater abilities in those exact areas. It's a beautiful idea. Psychologists call it adversarial growth and post-traumatic growth. That which doesn't kill me makes me stronger is not a cliche, but fact. The struggle against an obstacle inevitably propels the fighter to a new level of functioning. The extent of the struggle determines the extent of the growth. The obstacle is an advantage, not adversity. The enemy is any perception that prevents us from seeing this. Of all the strategies we talked about, this is the one you can always use. Everything can be flipped, seen with this kind of gaze. A piercing look that ignores the package and sees only the gift. Or we can fight it the entire way. The result is the same. The obstacle still exists. One just hurts less. The benefit is still there below the surface. What kind of idiot decides not to take it? Now the things that other people avoid or flinch away from, we're thankful for. When people are rude or disrespectful, well, that means they underestimate us. A huge advantage. Conniving? Well, we won't have to apologize when we make an example out of them. Critical or question our abilities? Lower expectations are easier to exceed. Lazy makes whatever we accomplish seem all the more admirable. It's striking. These are perfectly fine starting points, better in some cases than whatever you'd have hoped for in the best case scenario. What advantage do you derive from someone being polite or pulling their punches? Behind the behaviors that provoke an immediate negative reaction is an opportunity, some exposed benefit that we can seize mentally and then act upon. So focus on that, on the poorly wrapped and initially repulsive present you've been handed in every seemingly disadvantageous situation. Because beneath the packaging is what we need, often something of real value, a gift of great benefit. No one is talking glass half full style platitudes here. This is a complete flip. See it through the negative, past its underside, and into its corollary, the positive. Prepare to act. Then imitate the action of the tiger, stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood. Shakespeare. Problems are rarely as bad as we think, or rather, they are precisely as bad as we think. It's a huge step forward to realize that the worst thing to happen is never the event, but the event and losing your head, because then you'll have two problems, one of them unnecessary and post hoc. The demand on you is this. Once you've seen the world as it is, for what it is, you must act. The proper perceptions, objective, rational, ambitious, clean, isolate the obstacle and exposes it for what it is. A clearer head makes for steadier hands. And then those hands must be put to work. Good use. We all have to make assumptions in life. We have to weigh the costs and the benefits. No one is asking you to look at the world through rose-colored glasses. No one is asking for noble failure or martyrdom. But boldness is acting anyway, even if you understand the negative and the reality of your obstacle. Decide to tackle what's in your way, not because you're a gambler defying the odds, but because you've calculated them and boldly embraced the risk. After all, now that you've managed perceptions properly, what's next is to act. Are you ready? Part 2. Action. What is action? Action is commonplace. Right action is not. As a discipline, it's not any kind of action that will do, but directed action. Everything must be done in the service of the whole. Step by step, action by action, we'll dismantle the obstacles in front of us. With persistence and flexibility, we'll act in the best interest of our goals. Action requires courage, not brashness, creative application and not brute force. Our movements and decisions define us. We must be sure to act with deliberation, boldness, and persistence. These are the attributes of right and effective action. Nothing else. Not thinking or evasion or aid from others. Action is the solution and the cure to our predicaments. The discipline of action. There was little evidence that Demosthenes was destined to become the greatest orator of Athens, perhaps in history. He was born sickly and frail with a nearly debilitating speech impediment. At 7 years old, he lost his father, and then things got worse. The large inheritance left to him, intended to pay for tutors in the best schools, was stolen by the guardians entrusted to protect him. They refused to pay his tutors, depriving him of the education he was entitled to. Still weak and sick, Demosthenes was also unable to distinguish himself in the other critical sphere of Greek life, the floor of the gymnasia. Here was this fatherless, effeminate, awkward child who no one understood, who everyone laughed at. Not exactly the boy you'd expect would soon hold the power to mobilize a nation to war with his voice alone. Disadvantaged by nature, abandoned by the people he depended on, nearly every wrong that could be inflicted on a child befell Demosthenes. None of it was fair, none of it was right. Most of us, were we in his position, would have given up right then and there. But Demosthenes did not. Stuck in his young mind was the image of a great orator, a man he'd once witnessed speaking at the court in Athens. This lone individual, so skilled and powerful, had held the admiration of the crowd who hung on his every word for hours, subduing all opposition with no more than the sound of his voice and the strength of his ideas. It inspired and challenged Demosthenes, weak, beaten on, powerless, and ignored. For in so many ways, this strong and confident speaker was the opposite of him. So he did something about it. To conquer his speech impediment, he devised his own strange exercises. He would fill his mouth with pebbles and practice speaking. He rehearsed full speeches into the wind or while running up steep inclines. He learned to give entire speeches with a single breath. And soon his quiet, weak voice erupted with booming, powerful clarity. Demosthenes locked himself away underground, literally, in a dugout he had built to study and educate himself. To ensure he wouldn't indulge in outside distractions, he shaved half his head so he'd be too embarrassed to go outside. and from that point forward, he dutifully descended each day into his study to work with his voice, his facial expressions, and his arguments. When he did venture out, it was to learn even more. Every moment, every conversation, every transaction was an opportunity for him to improve his art. All of it aimed at one goal, to face his enemies in court, to win back what had been taken from him, which he did. When he came of age, he finally filed suits against the negligent guardians who had wronged him. They evaded his efforts and hired their own lawyers, but he refused to be stopped. Flexible and creative, he matched them suit for suit and delivered countless speeches. Confident in his new strengths, driven on by his own toil, they were no match. Demosthenes eventually won. Only a fraction of the original inheritance remained, but the money had become secondary. Demosthenes' reputation as an orator, ability to command a crowd, and his peerless knowledge of the intricacies of the law was worth more than whatever had remained of a once great fortune. Every speech he delivered made him stronger. Every day that he stuck with it made him more determined. He could see through bullies and stare down fear. In struggling with his unfortunate fate, Demosthenes found his true calling. He would be the voice of Athens, its great speaker and conscience. He would be successful precisely because of what he'd been through and how he'd reacted to it. He had channeled his rage and pain into his training, and then later into his speeches, fueling it all with a kind of fierceness and power that could neither be matched nor resisted. Some academic once asked Demosthenes what the three most important traits of speechmaking were. His reply says it all. Action, action, action. Sure, Demosthenes lost the inheritance he'd been born with, and that was unfortunate. But in the process of dealing with this reality, he created a far better one, one that could never be taken from him. But you, when you're dealt a bad hand, what's your response? Do you fold, or do you play it for all you've got? There's an explosion, metaphoric or otherwise. Are you the guy running toward it, or running away from it? Or worse, are you paralyzed and do nothing? This little test of character says everything about us. And it's sad that so many of us fail, opting away from action, because action is natural, innate. You trip and fall right now, your body's instincts protect you. You extend your hands to break your fall so you don't break your face. In a vicious accident, you go into shock but still manage to get your arms up around your face. That's where the term defensive wounds comes from. We don't think, we don't complain, we don't argue, we act. We have real strength, more strength than we know. But in our own lives, when our own worst instincts are in control, we dally. We don't act like Demosthenes. We act frail and are powerless to make ourselves better. We may be able to articulate a problem, even potential solutions, but then weeks, months, or sometimes years later, the problem is still there. Or it's gotten worse, as though we expect someone else to handle it. As though we honestly believe that there's a chance of obstacles un-obstacling themselves. We've all done it. Said, I'm so overwhelmed, or tired, or stressed, or busy, or outmatched, or blocked. And then what do we do about it? We go out and party, or we treat ourselves, or sleep in. It feels better to ignore or pretend. You know deep down that this isn't truly going to make it any better. You've got to act. You've got to start now. We forget, in life it doesn't matter what happens to you or where you came from. It matters what you do with what happens and what you've been given. And the only way you'll do something spectacular is by using it all to your advantage. People turn shit into sugar all the time. Shit that's a lot worse than whatever we're dealing with. I'm talking physical disabilities, racial discrimination, battles over overwhelmingly superior armies. But those people didn't quit. They didn't feel sorry for themselves. They didn't delude themselves with fantasies about easy solutions. They focused on the one thing that mattered, applying themselves with gusto and creativity. Born with nothing into poverty, strife, or the chaos of decades past, certain types of people were freed from modern notions of fairness or good or bad, because none of it applied to them. What was in front of them was all they knew and all they had. And instead of complaining, they worked with it. They made the best of it. Because they had to, because they didn't have a choice. No one wants to be born weak or be victimized. No one wants to be down to their last dollar. No one wants to be stuck behind an obstacle blocked from where they need to go. Such circumstances are not impressed by perception, but they are not indifferent, or rather immune, from action. In fact, that's the only thing these situations will respond to. No one is saying you can't take a minute to think, damn it, this sucks. By all means, vent, exhale, take stock. Just don't take too long, because you have to get back to work, because each obstacle we overcome makes us stronger for the next one. But no, no excuses, no exceptions, no way around it. It's on you. We don't have the luxury of running away, of hiding, because we have something very specific we're trying to do. We have an obstacle we have to lean into and transform. No one is coming to save you, the safety net is gone, and if we'd like to go where we claim we want to go, to accomplish what we claim are our goals, there is only one way, and that's to meet our problems with right action. Therefore, we can always and only greet our obstacles with energy, with persistence, with a coherent and deliberate process, with iteration and resilience, with pragmatism, with strategic vision, with craftiness and savvy, and an eye for opportunity in pivotal moments. Are you ready to get to work? Get moving. We all must either wear out or rust out. Every one of us. My choice is to wear out. Theodore Roosevelt. Amelia Earhart wanted to be a great aviator, but it was the 1920s and people still thought that women were frail and weak and didn't have the stuff. Women's suffrage wasn't even a decade old. She couldn't make her living as a pilot, so she took a job as a social worker. Then one day the phone rang. The man on the line had a pretty offensive proposition, along the lines of, "We have someone willing to fund the first female transatlantic flight. Our first choice is already backed out. You won't get to actually fly the plane, and we're going to send two men along as chaperones, and guess what? We'll pay them a lot of money, and you won't get anything. Oh, and you very well might die while doing it." And you know what she said to that offer? She said, yes. Because that's what people who defy the odds do. That's how people who become great at things, whether it's flying or blowing through gender stereotypes, do. They start. Anywhere, anyhow. They don't care if the conditions are perfect or if they're being slighted. Because they know once they get started, if they can just get some momentum, they can make it work. As it went for Amelia Earhart. Less than 5 years later, she was the first woman to fly solo nonstop across the Atlantic and became, rightly, one of the most famous and respected people in the world. But none of that would have happened had she turned up her nose at the offensive offer or sat around feeling sorry for herself. None of it could have happened if she'd stopped after that first accomplishment either. What mattered was that she took the opening and then pressed ahead. That was the reason for her success. Life can be frustrating. Oftentimes we know what our problems are. We may even know what to do about them, but we fear that taking action is too risky, that we don't have the experience, or that it's not how we pictured it, because it's too expensive, because it's too soon, because we think something better might come along, because it might not work. And you know what happens as a result? Nothing. We do nothing. So tell yourself, the time for that has passed. The wind is rising. The bell's been rung. Get started. Get moving. We often assume that the world moves at our leisure. We delay when we should initiate, we jog when we should be running, or better yet, sprinting. And then we're shocked, shocked, when nothing big ever happens, when opportunities never show up, when new obstacles pile up, or the enemies finally get their act together. Of course they did. We gave them room to breathe. We gave them the chance. So the first step is, take the bat off your shoulder and give it a swing. You've got to start to go anywhere. Now let's say you've already done that. Fantastic. You're already ahead of most people. But let's ask an honest question. Could you be doing more? You probably could. There's always more. At a minimum, you could be trying harder. You might have gotten started, but your full effort isn't in it, and that shows. Is that going to affect your results? No question. In the first years of World War II, there was no worse assignment for British troops than being sent to the North African front. Methodic and orderly, the British hated the grueling weather and the terrain that wreaked havoc on their machines and their plans. They acted how they felt. Slow, timid, cautious. German Field Marshal General Erwin Rommel, on the other hand, loved it. He saw war as a game, a dangerous, reckless, untidy, fast-paced game. And most important, he took to this game with incredible energy and was perennially pushing his troops forward. The German troops had a saying about him, "Where Rommel is, there is the front." That's the next step, ramming your feet into the stirrups and really going for it. That's definitely not what they say about most leaders today. While overpaid CEOs take long vacations and hide behind email autoresponders, some programmers working 18-hour days coding the startup that will destroy that CEO's business. And if we're honest, we're probably closer to the former than the latter when it comes to the problems we face, or don't face. While you're sleeping, traveling, attending meetings, or messing around online, the same thing is happening to you. You're soft. You're not aggressive enough. You're not pressing ahead. You've got a million reasons why you can't move at a faster pace. This all makes the obstacles in your life loom very large. For some reason, these days, we tend to downplay the importance of aggression, of taking risks, of barreling forward. It's probably because it's negatively associated with certain notions of violence or masculinity. But of course, Earhart shows that that isn't true. In fact, on the side of her plane, she painted the words, "Always think with your stick forward." That is, you can't ever let up your flying speed. If you do, you crash. Be deliberate, of course, but you always need to be moving forward. And that's the final part. Stay moving. Always. Like Earhart, Rommel knew from history that those who attack problems in life with the most initiative and energy usually win. He was always pushing ahead, keeping the stampede on the more cautious British forces to devastating effect. His string of offenses at Cyrenaica, Tobruk, and Tunisia led to some of the most astonishing victories in the history of warfare. He got started early, while the British were still trying to get comfortable, and as a result, Rommel was able to seize what appeared to be an unstoppable advantage in some of the most uninhabitable terrain on the planet. He blew right through the bleak battlefields of North Africa, with their enormous distances, blinding sandstorms, scorching heat, and lack of water, because he never, ever stopped moving. It surprised even his commanding officer, who time and time again attempted to slow Rommel down. They preferred deliberation and discourse to advancement. It had a devastating effect on the momentum that Rommel had built with his troops, just as it does in our own lives. So when you're frustrated in pursuit of your own goals, don't sit there and complain that you don't have what you want or that this obstacle won't budge. If you haven't even tried yet, then of course it will still be in the exact same place. You haven't actually pursued anything. We talk a lot about courage as a society, but we forget that at its most basic level, it's really just taking action. Whether that's approaching someone you're intimidated by or deciding to finally crack a book on a subject you need to learn. Just as Earhart did, all the greats you admire started by saying, "Yes, let's go." And they usually did it in less desirable circumstances than we'll ever suffer. Just because the conditions aren't exactly to your liking, or you don't feel ready yet, doesn't mean you get a pass. If you want momentum, you'll have to create it yourself, right now, by getting up and getting started. Practice persistence. He says the best way out is always through. And I agree to that, or insofar as I can see no way out but through. Robert Frost. For nearly a year, General Ulysses S. Grant tried to crack the defenses of Vicksburg, a city perched high in the cliffs of the Mississippi, critical to the Confederacy's stranglehold on the most important river in the country. He tried attacking head-on. He tried to go around. He spent months digging a new canal that would change the course of the river. He blew the levees upstream and literally tried to float boats down into the city over flooded land. None of it worked. All the while, the newspapers chattered. It had been months without progress. Lincoln had sent a replacement, and the man was waiting in the wings. But Grant refused to be rattled, refused to rush or cease. He knew there was a weak spot somewhere. He'd find it, or he'd make one. His next move ran contrary to all conventional military theory. He decided to run his boats past the gun batteries guarding the river, a considerable risk because once down, they cannot come back up. Despite an unprecedented nighttime firefight, nearly all the boats made the run unharmed. A few days later, Grant crossed the river about 30 miles downstream at the appropriately named Hard Times, Louisiana. Grant's plan was bold. Leaving most of their supplies behind, his troops had to live off the land and make their way up the river, picking town after town along the way. By the time Grant laid siege to Vicksburg itself, the message to his men and his enemies was clear. He would never give up. The defenses would eventually crack. Grant was unstoppable. His victory wouldn't be pretty, but it was inexorable. If we're to overcome our obstacles, this is the message to broadcast, internally and externally. We will not be stopped by failure. We will not be rushed or distracted by external noise. We will chisel and peg away at the obstacle until it is gone. Resistance is futile. At Vicksburg, Grant learned two things. First, persistence and pertinacity were incredible assets, and probably his main assets as a leader. Second, as often is the result from such dedication, in exhausting all the other traditional options, he'd been forced to try something new. That option, cutting loose from his supply trains and living off the spoils of hostile territory, was a previously untested strategy that the North could now use to slowly deplete the South of its resources and will to fight. In persistence, he'd not only broken through. In trying it all the wrong ways, Grant discovered a totally new way, the way that would eventually win the war. Grant's story is not the exception to the rule. It is the rule. This is how innovation works. In 1878, Thomas Edison wasn't the only person experimenting with incandescent lights, but he was the only man willing to test 6,000 different filaments, including one made from the beard hair of one of his men, inching closer each time to the one that would finally work. And of course, he eventually found it, proving that genius often really is just persistence in disguise. In applying the entirety of his physical and mental energy, in never growing weary or giving up, Edison had outlasted impatient competitors, investors, and the press to discover, in a piece of bamboo of all things, the power to illuminate the world. Nikola Tesla, who spent a frustrated year in Edison's lab during the invention of the light bulb, once sneered that if Edison needed to find a needle in a haystack, he would, quote, proceed at once to simply examine straw after straw until he found the object of his search. Well, sometimes that's exactly the right method. As we butt up against obstacles, it's helpful to picture Grant and Edison. Grant with a cigar clenched in his mouth, Edison on his hands and knees in the laboratory for days straight, both unceasing, embodying cool persistence in the spirit of the line from Alfred Lord Tennyson's poem about that other Ulysses, to strive, to seek, to find. Both refusing to give up, turning over in their minds option after option, and trying each one with equal enthusiasm, knowing that eventually, inevitably, one will work. Welcoming the opportunity to test and test and test, gracious for the priceless knowledge this reveals. The thing standing in your way isn't going anywhere. You're not going to outthink it or outcreate it with some world-changing epiphany. You've got to look at it and the people around you, who have begun their inevitable chorus of doubts and excuses, and say, as Margaret Thatcher famously did, "You turn if you want to. The ladies not for turning." Too many people think that great victories like Grant's and Edison's came from a flash of insight, that they cracked the problem with pure genius. In fact, it was the slow pressure, repeated from many different angles, the elimination of so many other promising options, that slowly and surely churned the solution to the top of the pile. Their genius was unity of purpose, deafness to doubt, and the desire to stay at it. So what if this method isn't as scientific or proper as the others? The important part is that it works. Working at it works. It's that simple. But again, not easy. For most of what we attempt in life, chops are not the issue. We're usually skilled and knowledgeable and capable enough. But do we have the patience to refine our idea? The energy to beat on enough doors until we find investors or supporters? The persistence to slog through the politics and the drama of working with a group? Once you start attacking an obstacle, quitting is not an option. It cannot enter your head. Abandoning one path for another that might be more promising? Sure, but that's a far cry from giving up. Once you envision yourself quitting altogether, you may as well ring the bell. It's done. Consider this mindset. Never in a hurry, never worried, never desperate, never stopping short. Remember and remind yourself of just two words that Epictetus said, persist and resist. Persist in your efforts, resist giving in to distraction, discouragement, or disorder. There's no need to sweat this or feel rushed, no need to get upset or despair. You're not going anywhere, you're not going to be counted out. You're in this for the long haul. Because when you play all the way to the whistle, there's no reason to ever worry about the clock. You know you won't stop until it's over, that every second available is yours to use. So temporary setbacks aren't discouraging, they are just bumps along a long road that you intend to travel all the way down. Doing new things invariably means obstacles. A new path is, by definition, uncleared. Only with persistence and time can we cut away debris and remove impediments. Only in struggling with the impediments that made others quit can we find ourselves in untrodden territory. Only by persisting and resisting can we learn what others were too impatient to be taught. It's okay to be discouraged. It's not okay to quit. To know you want to quit, but to plant your feet and keep inching closer until you take the impenetrable fortress you've decided to lay siege to in your own life. That's persistence. Edison once explained that in inventing, the first step is an intuition and comes with a burst. Then difficulties arise. What set Edison apart from other inventors is the tolerance for these difficulties and the steady dedication with which he applied himself towards solving them. In other words, it's supposed to be hard. Your first attempts aren't going to work. It's going to take a lot out of you, but energy is an asset we can always find more of. It's a renewable resource. Stop looking for an epiphany and start looking for weak points. Stop looking for angels and start looking for angles. There are options. Settle in for the long haul and then try each and every possibility and you'll get there. When people ask where we are, what we're doing, how that situation is coming along, the answer should be clear. We're working on it. We're getting closer. When setbacks come, we respond by working twice as hard. Iterate. What is defeat? Nothing but education. Nothing but the first steps to something better. Wendell Phillips. In the Silicon Valley, startups don't launch with polished, finished businesses. Instead, they release their minimum viable product, the most basic version of their core idea with only one or two essential features. The point is to immediately see how customers respond. And if that response is poor, to be able to fail cheaply and quickly, to avoid making or investing in a product customers do not want. As engineers now like to quip, failure is a feature. But that's no joke. Failure really can be an asset if what you're trying to do is improve, learn, or do something new. It's that preceding feature of nearly all successes. There's nothing shameful about being wrong, about changing course. Each time it happens, we have new options. Problems become opportunities. The old way of business, where companies guess what customers want from research and then produce those products in a lab, isolated and insulated from feedback, reflects a fear of failure and is deeply fragile in relation to it. If the highly produced product flops on launch day, all that effort was wasted. If it succeeds, no one really knows why or what was responsible for that success. The MVP model, on the other hand, embraces failure and feedback. It gets stronger by failure, dropping the features that don't work, that customers don't find interesting, and then focusing the developers' limited resources on improving the features that do. In a world where we increasingly work for ourselves, are responsible for ourselves, it makes sense to view ourselves like a startup of one. And that means changing the relationship with failure. It means iterating, failing, and improving. Our capacity to try, is inextricably linked with our ability and tolerance to fail. On the path to successful action, we will fail, possibly many times, and that's okay. It can be a good thing, even. Action and failure are two sides of the same coin. One doesn't come without the other. What breaks this critical connection down is when people stop acting because they've taken failure the wrong way. When failure does come, ask, what went wrong here? What can be improved?